I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. This morning we're joined by golf course architect Jay Blasi. Jay was an integral part in the design of Chambers Bay under Robert Trent Jones Jr. design, and now is out on his own. Recently completed a great project at Santa Ana Country Club and is a big part of the Sharp Park movement and restoration in San Francisco. Jay, welcome on.
Thanks so much, Andy. I'm excited to join you.
Yeah, it should be fun. The thing I always like to start out with these conversations is I'm curious about how you got into golf and then when did you kind of decide you wanted to be a golf course architect?
Yeah, well, for me, it started really early. Kind of close to your heart. My dad grew up on the south side of Chicago and was a caddy at Beverly. And so that's how he fell in love with the game. And he met my mom at the University of Wisconsin and they settled in Madison. And so when I was born, he brought plastic clubs to the hospital. And when he was a teacher, and so he had summers off, and on his summers off, he worked on the grounds crew and he befriended the superintendent, who was a influential guy in Wisconsin from the superintendent side of things, Monroe Miller. And so when they built their first house, he convinced the superintendent to come over and build a putting green in the backyard. So I was lucky enough to grow up. I had a putting green in my backyard, and then we moved when I was young, and we ended up with a putting green with two little bunkers. And then we moved again, and then we moved out to the country and had 7 acres. So then we had three putting greens in the yard, or three little golf holes in the yard. So my interest in the game started, you know, literally when I was born and all through my childhood. And then my interest in architecture really started very young as well. When I was four or five, we'd go out to dinner and I'd flip the placemat over and draw golf holes and crayon. And we'd take all sorts of family vacations, always driving vacations, and I'd just spend the whole trip in the back seat with my face plastered to the window, looking out at the farm fields, envisioning golf holes and stuff. So the interest in that started very young, and then was very fortunate that and thank my parents again. They were really the ones who kind of gave me the push when it was time to go to college. I had figured out that most people in golf design had gotten a degree in landscape architecture, and so I knew that and was passionate about designing golf courses, but for some reason didn't necessarily think of it as a viable career or anything. And they were the ones who kind of kicked me in the butt and said, no, you got to go for this. If you're lucky enough to find a passion in life, you got to do it. You go into business, you know, at any time, but chase your dreams or whatever. And so I went to the University of Wisconsin, got a degree in landscape architecture, and after school ended up with RTJ too.
Nice. I mean, getting to do what you love and had a passion for since you're a kid is probably like the most rewarding thing ever. I mean, you work, it doesn't feel like work, which is got to be so refreshing for you.
It is, and I think that would be one thing that I would, you know, whether it's golf architecture or anything else. I mean, I think, you know, as a country, as a society, we'd be far better served if we really encouraged all of our young people to find a passion and chase that. Because if you're passionate about something, you're going to be good at it, and you're going to put in the extra time and effort and you know, everything is better. You know, when somebody's passionate about something, the outcomes are always better. So I feel fortunate. I pinch myself every day that I get to do this, and I wish more people had the opportunity to follow their dreams and chase their dreams.
Yeah, it's I imagine how long till you move out? You're in San Francisco. You can't have a putting green in your back now, yard now, I bet. But like, how long? You know, when are you going to get your putting green, your own putting green?
that's a great question. Yeah, there are no. I don't have any putting green here in the Bay Area. That's for sure. I feel very fortunate to have a roof and four walls. the cost of living out here, but I'm lucky enough that if I hop in the car and go 20 minutes, I get to make use of the Stanford practice facility. So that's a pretty good putting green backyard situation for me.
Yeah, that's good. So growing up, did you have to like take care of the putting green? Did you learn some like agronomy from that? And like who had to mow the green?
Well, I would mow it. My dad would mow it. I have a younger brother. He would mow it. I probably was not as good or in tune with the maintenance side of things as I should have been when I was little. But interestingly enough, yeah, my dad had this really old, cool mower that I think he had gotten somehow on some kind of auction or something and whatnot. And we'd mow it and whatnot. I did get to lay out the first little court. You know, when I talk about the backyard putting green, this is nothing too fancy. I mean, it's a small little residential lot, mm-hmm. but we made up a 18-hole course. You know, the longest shot was 15 yards, but we made up a little 18-hole course in the backyard. So that was probably my first layout, was laying out the 18-hole course, and then we made up a little scorecard, and we'd always have little competitions in the backyard. So it's a good way to grow up.
Yeah, it's funny. My buddy, I had a really good buddy growing up that lived up the street, and we both, you know, we'd play golf like all summer long together, but when we weren't at the course, we'd play front yard wiffle ball golf. And like, thank God, you know, God bless our neighbors, because we had all these different holes. You know, the street was a water hazard, and we'd play across into people's yards, and you know, trees were the holes. And I mean, it was so much fun. But you know, it was, you'd start to design kind of holes like, oh, this one's a dog leg left, like, and you gotta, you know, the different tough features of it, you have to lay up sometimes if you couldn't carry the street. So it's so fun when you're, you know, we wish you could go back to that almost.
Oh yeah, I've done the same thing, and it's great fun. Yeah, what's better than that, growing up like that as a kid? Uh-huh. I had a really funny thing happen, you know, just by happenstance. My next door neighbor, who I a number of times as a 6-year-old was taking divots out of his yard, you know, and here I am, you know, 28, 30 years later, I'm working on Century World back up in northern Wisconsin. And it was time to kind of make a pitch to the board of directors at Century Insurance, who were going to approve the project. And in walks my former next door neighbor, who now, you know, he's the head of he became the head of a energy company, and he's on the board of directors. And he looks and he lights up like a candle, and I look at him, and he just puts his arm around me, and he looks to the rest of the board. He goes, "The last time I saw Jay Fossey, he was hitting golf balls out of my backyard."
Yeah.
So it comes full circle.
Yeah.
It comes full circle.
That's it was, you know, thank God if any of my neighbors are listening, they got to, you know, they let me and my buddy just hack divots out of their front yard all the time. So I gotta be honest, I'm not the biggest Jones family fan. Having played a lot of their courses, I disagree with a lot of their principles, and I'm curious, from you working on the inside, you know, tell us a little bit about what it's like to work for RTJ2 and kind of how the whole design process works with a, you know, one of the biggest architectural firms in the world.
Yeah, so I think, you know, to touch on your comment first about, you know, the Jones family and design philosophies, I think it's important to to recognize, you know, when you talk about the family, there really are kind of three different parts to that tree, right? So you've got RTJ Senior, and then you've got the two sons, Bobby, RTJ 2, and Reese. And I think it's important to make sure that, you know, they're all kind of, it's easy to kind of lump them all together, but in reality, they're each their own entity, right? Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
I never had the chance to meet RTJ Senior. I know some of the, you know, many of the people in the RTJ 2 office, obviously, and Bobby will be, you know, tells lots of stories about his dad and stuff. So I never had a chance to meet him, and I've really spent very little time, been in the same room with Reese, but really haven't spent any time with him. So in terms of my experience at RTJ 2, it was a great experience, and that, you know, I was a kid right out of college, and you get the opportunity to work at, like you say, one of the bigger, more well-known design firms in the world. And you just get exposed to so much. I mean, there were projects all over the world. They came in all sorts of different shapes and sizes. So you were exposed to, you know, a municipal project that required a RFP and an RFQ. So you got exposed to that kind of process and what goes into trying to win a job that way. And at the same time, then another project was going to be a private club that was privately owned by a billionaire, right? So you're getting to see different ends of the spectrum from that side of things. The sites that came across, I mean, there would be sites that were really special and others that were not special at all. You'd see, you know, whether it was something in Asia that was a dead flat, you know, rice paddy, and then something else in Asia that was, you know, the side of a mountain, and then you'd see all, you know, so you got to see and got exposed to everything. And then you know, even in the golf design world, even the big firms, you know, what you call the big firms, they're not very big. I mean, we only had a half a dozen people, you know. So then you get to learn about each of those people, and they each have a different background and story, and they kind of have their own little design philosophy or things that tendencies that they like to do on the projects that they work on. So, you know, even if you don't agree 100% with each of with past work or each of the design philosophies, it was a wonderful opportunity and experience and great exposure to a wide variety of things, part of the golf business.
Yeah, I imagine the big firm allows you so many opportunities to, whether it's not even working on, but getting to just see great, you know, some of the best courses, you know, it and as well as, you know, getting to, you know, the volume of work. And the volume of projects is so high that you get inundated so much quickly as a young kid.
Yeah, I think coming right out of school, it was a great experience. You know, my first couple of years there, I didn't, you know, I was assisting other people, so I wasn't playing a real creative role in any project. But you know, when you see when the, you know, whether it was Bobby or somebody who was doing business development went out and they took a trip to Europe and they come back and they say, hey, I met with this guy and here's the topo map for this site, you know, and then somebody in the office puts together a preliminary routing just to see what could fit on the site or a preliminary grading plan. And then, you know, if my job then in those first couple of years was to, you know, trace that or draw it up pretty or enter it into the computer or whatever, you know, that's an opportunity. You know, how many 22-year-olds get the opportunity to spend 6 hours looking at the topo map and routing and trying to understand? And so what I would do is I would do whatever I was supposed to be doing, which is, you know, drawing up somebody else's idea, and then I'd take that same topo map and take it home at night and and lay out my own course. Uh-huh. And do my own thing. And then I'd bring it in and share it with whoever I was working with and say, hey, you know, give me some feedback on this, you know? So again, just kind of great exposure all the way around.
Yeah. Yeah. What would you say you learned most, during your time there?
Well, I think it was, it was probably not any one lesson, but there were just exposure to different things, like, you know, exposure to the RFP process for public projects and meeting with clients from all around the world and different cultures and different backgrounds. And one thing that Bobby pointed out one day we were on site that is something that I take with me and still think about a lot is we were out there talking about, a certain golf hole and you know, he was asking me to walk him through my thoughts on something. And then he said, well, you know, it's important to remember that people see things differently. Just because you and I are standing next to each other looking at the same thing doesn't mean that we see it the same way. And so it's really important to be really good with communication and make sure that you're verbalizing and you're talking and you're working with whoever you're working with on the project, whether it's the owner or another designer or the contractor or whoever, to make sure that you really communicate well and understand what they're seeing. Don't just assume that because you're standing next to each other looking at the same thing that you see the same thing. So that's something that I took away and I use every day.
Yeah, I feel like that's like when people get to walk with an architect, and I see it, you know, when I've gotten the opportunity to play with some architects, is like, you know, they see things in such a different way. And, you know, I feel like I'm pretty well read and I see things in certain ways, but and being able to communicate that to someone is so tough, because a lot of times, like, the person you're dealing with on a project, from whether it be a club side or an owner side, isn't necessarily as well read and don't understand, you know, the principles behind architecture.
Absolutely. That is so true. And you see that on it. You know, I see that on every project I work on, and it just becomes more and more clear over time. And it makes sense. You know, if somebody were trying to explain to me, you know, the details of the, you know, the wiring in the house, you know, I wouldn't understand what they're talking about, and they could be eloquent and walk me through it at a basic level, and I may or may not get it, right? But, you know, as a golf architect, yeah, I go out and I, you know, look at an existing golf hole, and I can immediately, right in my mind, see what I might want it to be, or see an alternative, or if you're looking at vacant land, you know, you can go out there and you can see right away how you might want certain things to unfold. But the ability to try to communicate that and walk people through that is, it's an important skill, and it's a challenging exercise. I think when we were working on Santa Ana over the last few years, we would, I spent a lot of time with the members kind of walking through what the vision is, what the plans were, and then we'd have like a construction walkthrough, you know, so we'd be in the middle of construction, and Friday afternoon we'd invite the members out, we'd go walk around, and I'd walk them through, okay, here we are, we're on the first hole, we're on the left-hand side, we're starting to shape a bunker over there, the green's going to be up ahead, and this is what we're trying to set up, and you'd walk people through that, and then say, are there any questions, and somebody would say, is there going to be a bunker? And I'd say, well, yeah, actually, I just told you, we're actually standing in the bunker right here. Oh, I couldn't see that. You know, looking at dirt is really, really hard for people. And as soon as the grass goes down, now all of a sudden kind of the aha moment comes. Oh, now I understand what you were telling me. But sometimes it's really tough along the way to, you know, for people who don't do this all day, every day to kind of see it.
Yeah. I the course I play at in Chicago, I've played there like 3 times this year, but it's an old Donald Ross, and all of our greens are like so small compared to what their original design was, and they're just small ovals and circles because of irrigation and maintenance things, and you know, it just happened over time. But you know, and then they put in these sprinklers, and you see sprinklers on where the green should be, and even trees on where. And I, you know, I texted my buddies, I took some aerial shots with my drone, and then, you know, photoshopped over them like where the green should be. And they, you know, nobody really knows what you're, you know, they look at it and they're like, oh, this guy's just crazy. But then when you play with them and you walk and you show them, it's like, look at this, where this green should go. And then look, imagine this pin. Like, imagine how this pin completely changes the hole, and how when you get these greens over close to the bunkers, how much more of a challenge it is. And it's not necessarily even just the pinnable surface. It's the stuff that's not pinnable that makes the ball roll off the green 10 yards.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm sure that they would be, you could talk to them for months and months and months, but if you snuck out in the middle of the night and mowed down the area in question to something close to green height, they'd probably see it a lot easier.
Yeah, it's... Yeah. We're hoping to do some of that this fall. But on the subject, what do you think went wrong with golf course architecture? Not to say there weren't any good projects, but with this dearth of projects that, you know, end up now being just, you know, kind of sores on the golf community from like 1960 to 2005.
Well, I think a couple things. So first, I might have a little bit different time frame, because I think that probably in the mid '90s there at least started to be a lot of better stuff that started to come about. So I don't know if you'd go, you know, from '95 to 2005. Sure, there were dozens of golf course, or maybe even hundreds of golf courses that people spent a lot of time and money on that aren't very special, but there also were some that are pretty special. So I'm not sure you want to lump them all together. But I think to me there's probably three things. So the first thing to keep in mind was that kind of coincided with technology advances in terms of earth moving, in terms of agronomy. So all of a sudden, whereas in the early 1900s, a golf course was pretty much built where a golf course should be built, right? A group of people would get together and they'd say, hey, we're interested in forming a golf club. And they'd go out and they'd find the appropriate land because they didn't have the ability to create their own environment, right? So they had to find an environment that was suitable for golf. And so the land was better, you know, there weren't golf carts, so now you're laying out a golf course that's walkable, and you're trying to lay one out that doesn't require earth moving. So now fast forward to the 60s, and all of a sudden we're building golf courses probably where they don't belong. We're building them in swamps and deserts and mountainsides, and all of a sudden we've got golf carts and we've got big bulldozers. So now if the environment doesn't work for us, we'll create our own. And if the parcel doesn't work, well, we can piecemeal a couple of them together and play a hole and drive 200 yards and play another hole. So those are some of the things that probably went awry. The other thing is that the reason for building a golf course probably changed. You know, back in the early 1900s, people got together and they built a golf course because they wanted to play golf. The vast majority of the courses probably from 1960 on were probably built for a reason other than golf, whether that was to sell real estate or fill hotel rooms and be an amenity for some kind of a resort. So with those things in mind, the reasoning for having a golf course was different. That led to, in my opinion, what is very troubling, and that's just a ton of artificial features, right? So all of a sudden we're using the bulldozer to craft a new landscape, and we're building a bunch of artificial lakes, and we're planting flowers and planting trees everywhere, and now we've got golf carts, so we start putting in, you know, 7 miles of concrete ribbons all over the place. So all of the stuff that takes away from great golf and all the stuff that we love about the golf from the early 1900s, you know, we're kind of did the opposite for a big period of time there. And now we're kind of at a very interesting time in golf architecture in that we've got a lot of wonderful projects that really are you know, kind of recapturing the essence of the early 1900s, where somebody's building a golf course to build a special golf course because people want to play golf. And at the same time, then there's still also a number of projects where, you know, people are building a golf course to fill hotel rooms and to sell real estate. So you've kind of got this interesting dichotomy that's going on now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What would you say, you know, I think one of the things I think about it a lot is all these golf courses that were, you know, they aren't the best golf courses, but what happens to them in the future? Like, how can we, you know, can they be fixed and can they be made into something that's good for the game and a good golf course for people to play every day? And how do you go about doing that?
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting question. And like everything with golf, it's site specific, right? So the right solution on site A is not the right solution at site B. And the right solution in city A might not be the right solution in city B. But we're definitely at a time in golf where, you know, we have a lot more courses closing than opening. And what's interesting to me is the ones that are closing aren't always the worst golf courses, mm-hmm. right? So, which is tragic. But it seems one thing that I've certainly noticed is that there's so many, like you said, usually golf courses that were built from 1960 on or renovated from 1960 on that just leaves so much to be desired. And that's really a shame. And so I'm cautiously optimistic that over the next 20 years, many of those golf courses that, you know, one of my favorite things to do is to go look on Google Earth, right? You could just go around and go check out different golf courses all over the world or all over the country. And there are so many golf courses that might be in a good location, in a good city, in a good area. And then you go look at the golf course and every single hole, you know, the green is the same size oval. There's a bunker short left. There's a bunker short right. You know, there's usually one fairway bunker out there. Everything's been planted with trees over the last 40 years. So, you know that you're just hitting the same exact shot over and over again. You get up on every tee and keep it between the trees and you hit into every green and it's, you know, avoid the hazards right and left and get it onto the green and stay below the hole. So, mm-hmm. But those are golf courses that might be in a good area, where, you know, if and when the time comes to replace the infrastructure, the irrigation system and the drainage and stuff, rather than investing in all of that infrastructure and keeping things the way they are, when it's time to invest in the infrastructure, that's the time to make some changes and make sure that, hey, we can take this property that's already permitted as a golf course and already zoned as a golf course and has a good market and get rid of this mediocre thing and make something special and give people the stuff that we all kind of yearn for, the stuff from the early 1900s where people had options and angles and there was a lot of variety and strategy and thought to the round of golf.
It's interesting. I hosted a lot of people on this podcast and I've noticed over time that almost everybody, you know, I would say the vast majority of people that I host on this podcast that are involved with golf today grew up playing at a municipal or a public golf course. And I think to myself, okay, the majority of those experiences probably weren't the best golf course experiences. And imagine if those courses were really fun to play and had really sound architectural principles, not to mention the sustainability aspect of, you know, if you don't have too many hazards, how much cheaper it is to maintain and how these different little things, like how many more great people would we have, you know, involved with the game still if they grew up at a place that was really great to play.
Yeah, I think I certainly agree that municipal golf is important, and it's where many people got their start. I certainly got my start in Madison playing on municipal golf courses and loved it. And I wholeheartedly agree that it would be awesome. It doesn't cost any more money to build an architecturally interesting golf course than it does a architecturally uninteresting golf course, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're smart about it, you can craft one that's maybe easier to maintain as well at the same time, to your point. I guess where I may differ a little bit is that, you know, at that age, you know, as much as I was interested in golf as a 8-year-old or a 12-year-old, I probably wasn't at a point where I was really at least consciously understanding the difference of great architecture at that point. I think I was excited to have a safe place to go play golf and have fun with my friend, you know. And I think it's important that we certainly preserve and do everything that we can to make sure that municipal golf does stick around, because in today's climate, with city budgets and stuff like that, that's a tough task. I mean, if people have a choice between, you know, the fire department and the golf course, the fire department's going to win, and it probably should.
Yeah.
and yet the golf course does have a very important place in a community. It's a great community gathering spot. It's a place where people can have a healthy activity, but particularly if people walk, playing golf, and golf courses, Bobby always used to talk about the golf courses are kind of the green lungs of a city. You know, if you fly across America and look down, most of the green spaces in America's cities are golf courses. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's a great place to be outdoors and walk and get a good experience that way. And it's a great place to bring a community together.
Yeah, I think if you just focused on like city owned golf courses for like major metropolitan areas and really made those like really fun, cool places to play, it would make such a difference. I think about my home city, Chicago. We have a 9-hole course called Sydney Maravich. It used to be called Waveland up on the north side of the city. And it's right on the lake. I mean, it's right in the heart of the city. It's the easiest course to get to, but the golf course is just so bland and there's a lot of trees, it's tight, and you get a ton of beginners out there. And I always think, like, why not just take all the trees out, make it fairway grass all around, and you've got these beautiful lake views. And instead of it taking 4 hours to play 9 holes, it probably would take, you know, 3 hours or 2.5. And it'd be just a much more interesting golf course.
Let's do it. Yeah. I'm ready.
I just need to, I got to get in with big politics in Chicago, I guess.
Well, that's an easy thing to navigate. You know, yeah. I'm sure that, you know, one meeting and you share your vision and they'll be ready to go and make it happen. Right.
Yeah. No money, you know, just go in there. It's a pretty much bankrupt city. Just go in there and say, hey, we need a couple million for this. So I'm curious, just with, you know, being a younger architect and having seen you probably remember hitting a lot of golf balls. I remember it. We're close to the same age, and having lived through this change in technology and especially the golf ball. What do you see as like the future of golf course architecture? Because what we're seeing from the high level player is that really the skills that you need now are being able to hit the driver long and straight and be a good short iron wedge player and make putts. And this whole long iron and working the golf ball has kind of died with the advancements of the ball in the last 10 to 15 years.
No doubt about it. And the truth is that, you know, when you combine the technology advances and how that impacts the you know, really the 1%, the very top players of the game, golf is not sustainable at that. I mean, in order to, you know, if we're going to keep technology the way that it is, or keep allowing advancements in technology with, you know, the tour players and the college kids, I mean, you got to build a 8,500 or 9,000 yard golf course to challenge those guys. And that means more land, and then that means more water and more resources, and it's just not sustainable. So
not to mention a course that course is only played by 1% of the population.
Well, that's the thing, is that, you know, so much of the focus in the golf world and the attention and the media relates to a game that the other 90% aren't playing, right? So, but the sad thing is, what people see on TV is what they then, you know, kind of expect or demand at their facility. So, you know, Augusta National and the Masters, I mean, everybody in golf loves the Masters, and, you know, all golf architects appreciate Augusta National, right? I mean, there's nothing really bad to say about it, except for the fact that you could make the case that the televising of the Masters and Augusta National every spring, everybody who ever plays golf watches the Masters, and then they go and they expect or want those types of conditions at their golf course. And what they don't understand is that, you know, the golf course at Augusta is prepped all year for that event, and that they've got an unlimited budget, and that is not the case at your local muni in Chicago. And so now there's this, you know, everybody's pushing to make their golf course, you know, green. And I don't mean environmentally friendly green. I mean artificial green, and let's put white sand in the bunkers and do all these different things. So those are the things that aren't really sustainable. And kind of to your point earlier about municipal golf and stuff, I think we'd be well served to take a look at the Scots or take a look at Australia and see kind of how they do it. And if we want golf to thrive over the long haul, that's probably a better model to look to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. In terms of a project that you've been working on for now nearly a decade, the Sharp Park project, and it's the old Alistair McKenzie course in the city of San Francisco owns it. And, you know, it's a great seaside location that over the years has been, you know, a little bit altered for environmental reasons, but just basically a neglected course that could be one of the finest public golf courses in the world, designed by arguably the greatest architect of all time. Tell us a little bit about Sharp Park and, you know, the journey of that course.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up, because it is such a special place. It's actually in the city of Pacifica, which is about 15 minutes kind of south of San Francisco, but you're correct, the city does own the golf course. And so the reason that it's, like you say, a McKenzie golf course from the 30s, and it's been in the news, and I've been involved, like you say, for nearly a decade, because there was a threat that we were actually going to lose the golf course. There were federal lawsuits over habitat for frogs and snakes, and two local golfers and lawyers got together, Richard Harris and Bo Links, and these guys are true heroes in the golf world. So if people haven't heard of them, they should Google them and look them up and send them a thank you note. But they basically got together and said, hey, this national treasure, this museum, this monument's about to be stolen from us, and we're golfers and we're environmentalists, and this just doesn't have to be the case. And so they kind of rallied the troops and engaged you know, the right legal team, as well as the community, the golf community, the local golf community, and have rallied and saved the golf course. So over the last, you know, almost a decade, the course has been involved in legal battles, and thankfully, due to their great work, we keep winning each of those legal battles to preserve, to save the golf course. And then, you know, our dream is to be able to restore that, and we're actively working towards that, and I think we'll get there. It's a long process, like you talked about. You know, governments aren't easy. It's a site that does have challenges in terms of, you know, there's a number of different government agencies that have some kind of jurisdiction on the property. So navigating challenges constraints are difficult, but I think there's a great chance that in the near future we'll get to put some of that McKenzie back or unpolish some of the McKenzie that's been dusted over the years, and I think that will be something that hopefully the golf world will embrace. I know they already have to save the golf course, but hopefully they'll get a chance to come out and see something special in the years to come.
Yeah, it's something that I've been paying attention to, and you always want to see these courses. I have one in Chicago, is Downers Grove Golf Club, which is 9-hole course, but it's the original site of Chicago Golf Club. And over the years, the Park District, you know, since they took ownership of it, they've altered the course. They built a driving range, and now there's 4 original holes. But I always think about, like, man, how cool would this thing be to get back to what it was and have a 9-hole, you know, C.B. McDonald course that was his first design ever in America. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, you know, I think it sounds like a worthy cause to me. I mean, unfortunately, we're at a stage where stuff gets in the way, and so it is a challenge. And so that's why people like Richard Bowe, and I'm sure there are others in Chicago and across the rest of the country, that need to kind of step up and fight and save the day, because this stuff is worth fighting for. It is worth saving. You know, Shark Park, as much as we're all interested in it from the golf course standpoint and the McKenzie standpoint, it represents all that you would want about what a golf course should be to a community. You go out there today and you'll see people, you know, ages, you know, 5 to 90, you'll see, you know, 20 different ethnicities out there, and they're all, you know, most of the people are out there walking. It just represents what the game is all about. And so those places are certainly worth fighting for and doing everything in our power to save, and when we have a chance to restore them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's the same thing out there. It's, you know, it's a packed tee sheet, and that's part of the reason they haven't done anything, is that, you know, it's a 9-hole course that the community makes money on. So if it's not broken from a monetary standpoint in their eyes, why do anything, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's kind of the bleeding the slow death, right? If you've got a major open wound in the middle of your forehead, then you get to go to the emergency room. But if you've got a internal bleeding that you can't see, sometimes you don't see it until it's too late. So
that's a great analogy. I might have to use that. I've been talking about going to Park District meetings and just trolling the Park District for a while now. I might have to start doing that in the winter.
There you go.
I wanted to talk a little bit. You know, we've gotten on the subject of Golden Age architecture, and I know your kind of design principles are, you know, a throwback to the Golden Age. Who would you say are your biggest influences from the standpoint of architects?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think, again, that, you know, obviously McKenzie jumps to mind in terms of just exposure to his. Over time, I'm learning to appreciate more and more Ross from a routing standpoint, appreciate some of those routings. But again, it's tough to say, you know, I love all the kind of McDonald and Rayner stuff. It's interesting to see, particularly where they would go out of their way to, you know, if they had an idea, if they had to move a bunch of dirt to make it happen, they'd go for it, type of thing. So that's always interesting. I think, again, it's just site specific, right? So those principles that And in California, you get exposed a lot to George Thomas. So they're all unique and interesting and great and have different backgrounds to them. But you know, the overriding thing that I've kind of taken away from all of them was, you know, I personally love the idea of having golf courses be fun. I love the idea of golf courses being natural. I love the idea of strategy and the golf ball on the ground and what happens when the ball's on the ground. So I'm a huge fan of ground contours having strategic value. So I don't, you know, hard to say, you know, how each one impacts those overarching themes, but they all certainly contribute to it.
Mm-hmm. So outside of, say, McKenzie, if you could bring one golden age architect back and have like kind of dinner with him and have him consult on, say, your next project you do, which one would you bring back?
Great question. The cop out answer, but is actually probably accurate, would be it would depend on what the project was. Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So there's probably a different answer depending on what the site was and what the who the client was. So it probably depends. And then you got to get into the question of if it's just a dinner, are you picking somebody based on personality and the stories that you're going to be told? So you know, if you didn't have to pick up the bill, it might be Tillinghast.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's a known socialite, you know, interesting guy, and a great architect. It's amazing to me with the USAM at Riviera how I think the Philly Golf School and architecture. You know, for those that aren't familiar with it, I have an article on my site, but this whole Philly Golf School is incredible with George Thomas, A.W. Tillinghast, William Flynn, you know, then you have Hugh Wilson, Crump, and all these guys. You look at their work and they've started because of, you know, them getting their ass whooped in championship golf and championship amateur golf. And now you look back and they arguably have the majority of the timeless classic championship golf sites all came from those three guys or five guys.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome. No doubt about it. I mean, and to think back, spending a night talking to Walter Travis and talking golf architecture and then talking about playing career, you know, so mm-hmm. those would be, interesting conversations to have. All sorts of great things. It would be awfully fun to go back in time and have a round table or like you say, have a good dinner.
It's something I wonder, because like those guys like openly collaborated, and I think a lot of it, you know, one of the things that's changed is it wasn't as a business then as it is now, but that open collaboration, free flow of ideas led to such great work. And I ever wonder if that will happen again. I think it might be, you know, a little bit with, you know, how Corin Crenshaw with all their associates, you know, spawning out, and Doak with his intern program. But I always wonder, you know, do you ever have peers that you go to with, you know, asking them questions and bouncing ideas off of them?
Yeah, I think that's a great point that you bring up. And I think to me, that's one of the exciting things about this time in history, you know, and we touched on earlier that we have a little bit of a dichotomy going on, and that there's a number of projects that, you know, might be done for a housing development or fill hotel rooms and architecturally may not be very interesting. But then you've got a number of other projects that are very interesting and are on unique sites and sometimes very special pieces of land. And you know, when you think about the architecture world, yeah, you've got an interesting range of people in the industry, different ages and different backgrounds and coming from different family trees, if you will, of architecture. And so, yeah, I've been very fortunate to meet a number of different architects, old and young, and try to to keep in touch and bounce ideas and have chatted with different people about collaborating and doing different things. And I think those are things that hopefully, I think there's been a little bit of that. And you touched on kind of the, you know, whereas the collaboration in the early 1900s might have been the way we read about it now, you know, might have been these guys. But for anybody listening who hasn't been involved in a golf project, there is an endless amount of collaboration, you know, on every project, mm-hmm. whether it's the guy whose name you read in the magazine. But there are people, you know, the people who are shaping the golf course are involved, and there's regular on-site debates and conversations. And, you know, a good idea can come from anywhere, whether it's the client or the guy digging the trench. You know, a good idea can come from everywhere and anywhere. And there is a lot of collaboration on every project, but I think you will probably see more. You know, there'll probably be one-off projects, but you'll see more collaboration between people in the industry, and that's something that I like the idea of myself.
Yeah, I think it would be interesting to see if you did a modern day Pine Valley type project where you get five guys and you collaborate. Obviously, there has to be one person that's the boss, but you know,
gotta have a ringleader.
Yeah, you can't. And there has to be a unified vision. But like, you know, the idea of like Pine Valley, where like there, you know, the Hell's Half Acre hole, for example, is like notoriously a Tillinghast golf hole. And you know, you see different things, and the same thing with Marion, where there's so much Flynn in it that it could be considered a Flynn golf course. That you know, these golf courses became, you know, they're the greatest golf courses in the world, but you know, they were collaborated on and the spread of ideas. So I think we've talked about this pipe dream idea. I have enough. I'd love to talk a little bit about Chambers Bay, kind of your big project. And you did it, you were the project architect on it during your time at RTJ2. And it had the U.S. Open, it's had the U.S. Am, most recently it had the Pacific Coast Am. It, from all accounts, I mean, it's just a beloved golf course by people that play it, and also the players, you know, all rave about it. How, you know, like, and the only complaint always comes back to be, you know, the greens and the putting surfaces. How frustrating is it to have a course that is universally loved, but like the two things that, you know, the U.S. Open complained about was spectating and the green surfaces, which are really out of the architect's control?
Yeah. Lots to chew on there. I'll start by saying, you know, talk about kind of being universally loved, and I think that to be fair, I guess I would say that it's probably not universally loved. I know a number of the players who competed in the amateur and the open either didn't like it or hated it, and that was okay. If you look back in history, I would imagine that most special golf courses are somewhat polarizing, particularly early on. Well, and so that's okay.
Well, it's different also. You know, people always have like a reaction to it being different. You know, there's width, there's so much about angles and different ways you can play the course. So, you know, naturally, like these guys play the same style golf course almost week in, week out, narrow fairways, high rough. You know, is what I call robot golf, and Chambers definitely wasn't that style of golf.
Absolutely, and that was by design. For me personally, when you think about championship golf, and again, now we're just talking about the 1%, not everybody else, but to me, championship golf is way, way too much about execution and not enough about thought and strategy and creativity. And so, to your point, you know, week in, week out on the PGA Tour, it's, you know, very little thinking is required, right? Hit it between the trees, hit it between the bunkers, you know, avoid the pond, and just not a lot of thinking. And so, Chambers, you know, obviously it's a municipal course, it's open to everybody, but there always was the desire and intention to attract and host major championships. And one of the one of my great hopes for the project would be that the golf course would actually require golfers to think. And, you know, to your point earlier about technology and how it's changed a little bit of the game in terms of shot making. You know, the goal at Chambers was, you know, through the ground contours to ask players to hit the ball high and hit it low and, you know, move the ball left to right and move it right to left. And so, you know, the greatest joy I took out of both of those championships was to watch the best players in the game stand in the middle of the fairway and talk to their caddy and try to figure out how best to get the ball close to the hole, knowing that they had four or five different ways to do it, but if they were smart enough, they could actually figure out that one was would serve them far better than the other. So for me, you know, in 2010, watching Peter Uihlein stand in the fairway and talk to his caddy about, yeah, I'm 200 yards out, but do I want to fly at 180 with a draw into that slope and let it release, or do I want to fly at 190 and hit it high and land it at the toe of that slope with a fade to try and hold it. Those were the things that made me most excited. So from that standpoint, yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I was thrilled to death with how the amateur and the open unfolded. You know, the unfortunate thing about the open in particular, you know, it's the first year of Fox and their coverage, and unfortunately one of the storylines became the greens, and obviously the issues with some of the polling that had popped up, and it was very sad, because, you know, the people who pour their heart and soul into maintaining the golf course are friends of mine and very, very talented people, and they know what they're doing. And there was just kind of a big confluence of whether it was weather or championship prep or all these different things kind of led to something. And then it became a big storyline that took away from so many of the other great things about the event. So that was really the only negative, but I think over the long haul, those things will get worked out and everything will be fine in the future. And when we first built the project, when we were first getting started building it, you know, John Ladenburg, who was the county executive and the project visionary, you know, he made it clear in the very first meeting that, you know, this is a 100-year project. We're creating something here that's going to be here for multiple generations, and our goal is to get it right for them and to take the long view and to do everything in our power to make sure that, you know, future generations have a place to enjoy. And you know, that's the, you know, from a non-championship golf standpoint, that's the what makes Chambers Bay so special, is that every day there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people that go walk that public trail that is above and weaves through the golf course. There's, you know, golfers that are locals, and it's attracted golfers from all over the country and all over the world that have a different, you know, had never heard of Pierce County, Washington before, and now all of a sudden they come, and when they come, they stay and they spend money and support local businesses and things like that. So a lot to be excited about there.
Yeah, I think that's something that always gets lost, is like Chambers Bay is so young and its life is a golf course. And you think about, like, especially like Marion. I mean, Marion continued to undergo iterations and changes from their first USAM they hosted through all the way, I think it was 1916, they had their first USAM. And then, you know, the golf course really wasn't complete until 1934. And in the meantime, they'd hosted six or seven championships during that time. So, you know, the idea of, like, you know, a small change here and there. I mean, the golf course yielded probably the most exciting U.S. Open in the last decade. And I think it gets lost, especially with the U.S. Open mentality of the necessity of thick rough and seeing guys hack it out. Like, The most interesting golf is exactly what you hit on with Peter Uihlein talking about it, is when you can put doubt and you can put, you know, you have to, you're forcing the greatest players in the world to think about the type of shot they're playing in there is just the best kind of golf, where you start to see the shot making come to the forefront and you see the best players in the world having to hit different styles of golf shots that you don't see week in, week out.
Yeah, to my point, those were the things we're excited about. I mean, there's so many great takeaways. I mean, you think about it, you know, from a support standpoint, when the Open was at Chambers, when the Amateur was at Chambers, my understanding, everything I've been told, is that they had, you know, some of the best crowds ever and some of the best volunteer sign-up ever for an Amateur. For the Open, the volunteer, you know, sign up was their quickest ever fill up. They sold more merchandise there than they'd ever sold before or in, you know, many a decade or whatever. You know, it did well on TV. And then from a pure playing standpoint, you think about the Amateur. You had the number one Amateur in the world beat the number two Amateur in the world at the time for your finale. When you think about the Open, the number one, you know, the best player in the world at the time, won the championship. The leaderboard, if you look back, was probably the best leaderboard you've had in 20, 25 years. And certainly the back nine and the Sunday had, you know, probably the best leaderboards of anything in the last 25 years. So there's a lot of things to be excited about and positive takeaways, and clearly there were things that you'd like to refine and do over. You know, I think from a spectator standpoint, I was there all week, and you know, the USGA did a great job leading up to the event about sharing with the public that this was a little bit different of a US Open, and that the venue was such that you'd be far better served to go to a grandstand and watch two or three holes from a grandstand as opposed to trying to follow a group, you know, for all 18 holes. And that was the good part. The bad part was the public listened to them, and the public went to the grandstands, and by 9:30, 10 o'clock, all the grandstands were full. So then all of a sudden you had a bunch of traffic challenges with people walking around. But that's something that you can learn from. You can modify a roping plan. You can add more grandstands. You know, those are things that could be worked around. So, you know, it certainly was for me, you know, as a young guy, you know, who loves links golf, who loves municipal golf, who loves championship golf, whose dream in high school was to design a U.S. Open golf course, to be able to be part of that and watch it from the first day on site, interviewing, trying to get the job, and to go all the way through building the golf course, and then having an Open announced, and then watch and go all the way through. It's been a pretty interesting journey.
Yeah, it's got to be really cool. I envy the ability for you guys to just kind of watch your pro, you know, have your name on something and watch it and watch people's reactions, and then, you know, to get to see the whole world react to it. I mean, it's got to be pretty cool. I wanted to get to, we've got a lot of reader and or listener questions from Twitter, and I wanted to get to some of those. I'm not sure if you've ever listened to a pod, but we have an overrated, underrated segment. So they'll be peppered in there, and you just, you know, you can feel free to expand, but, you know, the general consensus, just say, you know, overrated or underrated on different topics. So those will be sprinkled in here. We'll start out with a overrated, underrated from Barry. Elevated greens and false fronts.
Are those two separate things?
False fronts? Yeah, we'll do two separate.
Underrated. I like a good false front, particularly on an uphill hole. Elevated greens, I'll go overrated. You know, I love golf where the ground game is an option. Mm-hmm. And so if you've got a green that's more at grade the aerial option is still always there.
Yeah.
But the ground game is something that I just love. So elevated greens have their place, but on balance, I'd just say overrated.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that's an easy way to make a lot of golf courses more playable, is just to lessen the grade of that front of the green, that because then, you know, more people can run the ball into them.
Absolutely. So again, go look at most golf courses between 1960 and 95, and almost all of them, the green is 2 to 3 feet above the elevation of the fairway. It just makes life so difficult for mid to high handicappers who, golf's difficult enough for that group. Takes so much fun and strategy out of it. So.
And it has zero effect on the 1% or the 10% we've been talking about.
Well, in some respects, it actually makes it easier for them, because they know they're just grabbing whatever club is going to fly to the middle of the green. You know, I don't know about you, but for me, if I see an open entrance green, I start thinking about running it in, even if I'm in a, you know, if I'm back in the Midwest and the conditions aren't firm and fast, if it's playing soft, even if it's playing soft and there's an open entrance, just my eye and my tendency to like the ball on the ground gets me thinking about going on the ground, even if it's not the right play due to conditions. So in some respects, the little elevated green might make life easier for the low handicapper.
Yeah.
You know,
get
some thought out of it.
I think also, especially around the green, because, you know, the lob wedge has become such a weapon for shots around the green, and when it's perched up, you don't even think about it. You just grab the lob wedge and you hit the shot. But when it's flat, you all of a sudden your mind starts to race and you start thinking about different things you could do. Do I land this, you know, 5 feet short and, you know, kind of hit a little checker? You know, there are all kinds of things. It's just more options are good. I think people just are tired of hearing me say that, but. Barry also had another question that is, I think, a really good one. He's a Hawaii guy, so he's very interested in wind and how it plays a factor in design. You know, the prevailing trade winds affects all courses in Hawaii, but then linksy options aren't always provided for the most part, meaning there's a lot of frustrated elevated greens that are tough to access with only one shot option. How do you approach prevailing winds?
So that's a great question, and wind really is it's one of the wonderful elements to the game. I think it's very hard to paint with a broad brush. Again, when it comes to golf and golf courses, everything is site specific. So you know, for example, if you're in Hawaii or in a windy place and you're building a new golf course and you have a lot of room, then the prevailing wind can impact your actual routing of the golf course and how you lay out the holes. Oftentimes that's not the case. You might have a parcel that's not as big, and where you route the holes is more a byproduct of the amount of space that you have, right? And you need to fit them in, fit the puzzle pieces in. But then you start to think about the wind on the individual design of the hole, if you will, right? And maybe where hazards are placed, or to our discussion earlier, whether or not the green is open entrance and at grade or elevated or not. So it's all very, very site specific. If you're fortunate enough to have an open site in a windy area, and you know, if you had the triple whammy of having sandy soil, then the prevailing wind can play an even bigger role in actually laying out the course. Otherwise, if you don't have all those luxuries, it probably is a bigger impact on the detailed design of the holes and the features.
That's a great answer. Here's some, with you being a Wisconsin native, we got some, you know, questions about the Badger State.
2 weeks, Andy. 2 weeks from today. Two weeks from today.
2 weeks.
Season start.
Brent Wagner wants to know, what course in Wisconsin would you most want to restore or redesign?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. In terms of redesign, that's probably not politically correct.
Yeah, we'll say restore.
We'll say restore. So there's some neat ones out there. There's probably a couple in Milwaukee that probably a couple private clubs in Milwaukee that probably would fit that bill. There's some underrated kind of hidden gem golf courses that are kind of neat. Our family spends a little bit of time up north. There's a 9-hole club, Rhinelander Country Club, that's pretty neat. I think I haven't played there in forever, but there's a course in the southeast that's I think kind of more of a mom and pop operation, Spring Valley, that's
Oh yeah.
got some pretty cool stuff going on. That would be great to peel back the layers and expose some of that stuff.
Langford
So
Moreau.
there's some neat, yeah. And
That.
so it's a great time of golf in Wisconsin. Wisconsin's becoming a hotbed for golf. So I'd love the opportunity to get back and do some stuff there. I was fortunate enough we did a redesign of Century World
Yeah.
that was very very satisfying and great client and very proud of what we've done up there. But yeah, I'd love the opportunity to get back and work in the Badger State.
Yeah, I'd love to. I think there's a Ozaukee Country Club could be so good if they got rid of some trees, and I mean that place has some really cool features.
Absolutely.
And
No doubt
that
about it.
have you ever played Eagle Springs?
Eagle Springs. I don't know that I have.
Oh man, you gotta
That
get
one's got
out
some cool
there.
stuff.
Well, it's the oldest
Yeah.
course in Wisconsin, and
Where exactly is it?
it's in, I want to say it's relatively close to I played it years ago. Let me see where it is. It's in, but it's got some just unbelievable green complexes, and it's the oldest course in Wisconsin. It's in Eagle, Wisconsin. So in, let's see, what is it? It's in Waukesha, I think, County.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So
All right, so
it's
outside
cool.
Milwaukee suburbs, yeah.
Yeah. But 9-hole course, and I mean, they've got this great volcano green and just some
Cool.
unbelievable green complexes. It's like that place could be really, really good. And you could go play there for, I think it's like $15 and walk. Let's see.
Yep.
And it's a great little course. It's summer weekend rate is walking is 1875. So
Very nice.
pretty
Yeah.
good.
So yeah, I mean Wisconsin's getting a lot of pub for all the big fancy places. But yeah, restoring some of the smaller gems would be a good thing too.
I like this question. HPS asked it for every pod. We don't get to it on every architecture pod, but if you could play one place on a Sunday afternoon with a Sunday bag, what course are you gonna play?
No. That's a tough one. There's so many to choose from. I've been lucky enough to go out to Prairie Dunes a few times, and that's a place I love to be out there with a Sunday bag on a Sunday afternoon. That's a pretty special place. But I'm in the Yeah, I'll stick with Prairie Dunes, but just know that there's a dozen of them that are, anything that's a good easy walk that has excitement and strategy and interest, I'm a happy camper.
Yeah, that's a tough question. I mean, I don't think there's a wrong answer. I mean, anywhere is pretty nice to do that, especially if there's nobody around, you can play it
Well,
quick.
if there's nobody around, I don't know if you're like me. If you're out there by yourself, you're playing, I'll hit a shot. You'll hit your approach shot into a green. And if you don't like how you hit the first one, then you drop another one and hit another one, and then you get up to the green. And once you get up to the green, then you may or may not, putt the ball you originally hit, but you might just start seeing different shots to hit and drop five or six balls around the green. If you're going to do that, then I'll stick with Prairie Dunes as a fun place to chip and putt.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things to do when I play by myself, is I just throw five balls into different spots around the green and try and get all five up and down. It's a fun way. I recommend it. It's great practice, too. All right. So KDW wants to know, what's the best way for an individual to begin getting into architecture?
Well, I'm sure you've probably touched on this in the past. I think there's lots of different routes. Again, tiny industry and small one to get into it. But there's a number of good books to read. And then if you're really serious about making it a career, I would encourage people to get involved in golf construction and golf course maintenance. I think both of those things are critical elements to have an understanding of, and the exposure of those opportunities will be invaluable. So, getting involved in golf course maintenance, getting involved in golf construction, and then, there's a number of great books on the subject that I'm sure that you probably have them listed on your website somewhere.
It's funny. I did a books article over the winter and I put a ton in there, but it's the most asked question I get. I get a couple emails a week, and I need to just write them down into a post, because what I end up doing is I end up replying the same way to all these questions. And it's like, God, why don't I just have like a post on the site that's like linked right by where somebody, the contact us page. So there's something I need to do.
I think the thing to, for people, every year, anytime, I'm on a plane and somebody asks me what you do, and then you tell them, oh my God, that's the coolest job in the world, I want to do that, And then you get others who say, I think the key thing for people is to really, for young people who are interested in golf architecture and want to make a career out of it, is to really think long and hard to yourself about, what do you want out of that career? Are you looking for fame and fortune and to be, do you read magazines and see magazine interviews or people on TV and you want to be that person? Or do you want to be a part of a team that builds golf courses, right? Because there's a number of opportunities for people who want to be a part of a team to build and maintain golf courses, but you may never, be on a magazine cover or on TV. And what you think you might want when you're 18 might be drastically different than what you realize you wanted when you're 40. But, it's certainly, I pinch myself every day that I get to be part of it and get to be involved in this. And I think there's anybody who's ever been involved in building a golf course, I think, would say that it's a magical process and one that's very rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a lot less glamorous than people think, especially at the start of your career.
I think, again, if you're looking for fame and fortune, probably not probably better off to go get that business degree and go make your money somewhere else. But if you want to wake up every day and know that you're going to get to interact with interesting, passionate people, and you get to be a part of doing something creative, and you're going to get to build something that's going to last for decades and decades, where generations of people are going to go make memories with their family and friends, then it's certainly a worthy pursuit.
Mm-hmm. Golf Architecture Texas wants to know, least favorite trend in modern golf course architecture.
Long list to choose from. I don't know the trends. I'll just say the overarching umbrella for me is artificial elements, whether it's a man-made lake or artificial mounding or concrete cart paths or flower beds or planted trees, all of these things. You know, again, we talked earlier about kind of making golf unsustainable. All of these things, in my mind, detract from golf rather than add to it.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with almost all of that. I think there's...
And rough.
Oh.
I hate rough. I'm on a mission, personal mission, to eliminate rough from the game of golf. I'd be happy to eliminate par, tee blocks. We could get rid of tee blocks while we're at it. All sorts of stuff to get rid of in the game.
Around the greens, rough, all it does is it diminishes skill and brings, you know, the great short games closer to the bad short games.
Yeah, I spent the last few years working on a project in Southern California at Santa Ana Country Club. And so the golf course that was there before we did our big project was essentially a 70s or 80s golf course. And every single green complex, you know, bunker, short left, short right, the green was all the same size and shape and surrounded by rough. And all the greens were elevated 3 feet, right? And so... you know, in going through the process and talking about, you know, what could be, we were trying to do some member education on the courses there. And you know, most members of a club, you play your course and you play there with your friends. It's what you know and you love, right? Mm-hmm. But when you really start to study golf courses, you can get a feel for, boy, I'm hitting the same shot over and over and over again. And, you know, if you went 20 yards around every single green at that golf course and probably the vast majority of other golf courses from that time period, everything within 20 yards is the same shot. It's a sand wedge, and it's either a lob shot out of rough or a lob shot out of a bunker. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, that's a very hard shot for a mid to high handicapper to execute. And it's not terribly tough for a low handicap to execute. And when you introduce the ground plane and now you've got tighter ground and different undulations and things are maintained firm and fast, now you can play the ball on the ground or in the air. You can those undulations, whether they're convex or concave, can be used. They can become a hazard or a helper, and it just brings out so much more in terms of strategy and creativity. And the nice thing is, for a higher handicapper, the options available to them, you know, if you're not able to hit that lob shot with a sand wedge, you can putt it. And so I just find that to be something that's critically important, and we hope we see a lot more of. I know there has been there's been a trend towards that, at least in some circles, and that's something I'd like to see more and more of.
Yeah, I agree. So last question, then we'll do a couple overrated underrated. I've taken up more than enough of your time. Johnny Begzos, if we rolled the golf ball back to the original Pro V1, would that save old courses?
Oh, I don't know that it's a one, you know, certainly addressing the golf ball and possibly addressing clubs together, I think, is critical. And again, this really relates to championship golf. I mean, mm-hmm. As much as the advances in technology have helped, you know, lesser players don't hit the ball 300 yards. It's these top one percenters that are flying at 320. And that's the real crux for championship golf. So I don't know if it's going back to the Pro V1. I don't know the exact right place to go back to, but I know we have to go back and have to get it under control. It needed to be done a long time ago, and we're long overdue. And when that happens, we'll be better served.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's something has to happen, at least on the professional level. I think it's good for the regular play, but I have less fun on the golf course now because of the ball.
Well, I'm somebody who loves to try different shots. And even though I've maybe executed the shot previously in my life, I'm not good enough to execute it on demand. But if I see a shot that demands a fade, I want to try and hit a fade. And so I love working the ball, right to left, left to right, high, low. Even if I'm not good enough to pull it off, it just makes golf that much more fun. But getting back to some of those days would be a good thing. I'll be very curious to see how the Masters and Augusta National fits into that equation. I think they have a golden opportunity. There isn't a player on earth that's going to turn down an invitation to the Masters. And if they said, oh, by the way, in 2018, we're going to be playing with a tournament ball, every pro is still going to show up and they're going to be excited about it. So I'll be curious to see their role in everything, because I think they've got the easiest opportunity to make something happen there.
Unfortunately, buying that land might be a bad, they might be adding length.
Yeah, I know.
Right. Very sad.
Adding length and planting trees seems to have been the model over the last 30 years. Hopefully they'll be the next 30 years might be a little different.
Yeah. So we'll get the final overrated, underrated here. I'm going to say green speeds and stimp readings. Overrated, underrated?
Overrated. Certainly, I'm a big fan of greens with. I like greens with contour or speeds that match the contour. Let's just put it that way. Mm-hmm. A different speed for a different set of greens is probably the right answer. But this love affair with 13 on the stimp meter just means that greens need to get flatter and flatter and more boring and more boring, or if you've got greens with contour and you maintain them at 13, then they're unplayable and no fun, and people get upset and want to change the green. So,
it's like Nairn in Scotland has a sign that says, we're on the windiest property on earth, so our green speeds are 5 to 6. So just deal with it. There's a lot of factors that go into it. Last one would be the Great Hazard.
Great Hazard.
So good, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, golf is supposed to be fun, and what's more fun than a Great Hazard, right?
Oh, yeah. I get a lot of shit because I love it so much. But it's so good.
Great stories come from the Great Hazard.
Yeah. Right?
So the more great hazards, the more great stories.
It's a fun design. It is a forced carry for the higher handicap, but like one or two of those in a round is so good because it's so thrilling for them.
Well, I think you did touch on a good point there, that it could be overdone. We don't need it on 18 holes, but the idea of it at a point or two in the round certainly makes for great fun and great interest in my mind.
Yeah. Well, hey, thanks for coming on. Look forward to meeting next week at the Renaissance Cup. And who knows, there might be a late night podcast on there. You got to figure that out.
that could be interesting.
Yeah.
That could be interesting. Andy, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. I tune in regularly and appreciate all that you're doing, and I know all the listeners do too. So keep up the good work.
Yeah, follow Jay on Twitter. What is it? Is it at Jay?
At Jay Blasey.
All right, I don't even know my own Twitter handle, so don't be offended. So, all right, have a good one, and we'll see you in a couple days.